at one point, like, we had a bunch of new people at the management team, like, joining. And one of the things that one of them said, it was sort of very interesting, said, "You guys are too digital. I'm analog. I think you guys need an injection of analogism, because you're not going to be able to create the new thing. You're not going to be able to sort of make something that's too different than what you're making right now, just based on looking at, like, retrospective data."
Hi there. Lee Brooks here from Cromulent Marketing, bringing you another episode of the Community Podcast. My guest this time around is Cassio Sampaio, a seasoned tech veteran who's worked in Brazil, the Czech Republic, Canada, and the US, and who now makes his home in the heart of Silicon Valley. Cassio's career includes stints running professional services departments, product management teams, and marketing organizations, but I was particularly excited to explore his experience with corporate development, and in particular, mergers and acquisitions. Let's get to it.
This is exciting because the Community Podcast is going international. So it's a big step. Flew all the way out here, so to this undisclosed location. So thanks.
I guess you and I have a history of going to undisclosed locations and doing things together without selling others, right?
It's true. I was actually thinking about this a bit last night. What places have we been together? And it's actually a pretty short list. We've been to a lot of places, but independently. Together, I think it's Rotterdam, Barcelona, Texas, Tokyo, London. I don't think we were in Zurich at the same time.
You're right, yeah,
we're not. You'd already done all your stuff, and then I went in to do
it. No, I think we were there at the same time, right? In that meeting with Scott Hamilton. I'm pretty sure we're there.
Rotterdam. Were you there? Anyway.
Anyways, like, yeah, somewhere in Europe, as they say, right?
yeah. And here we are again in a valley, I guess, that's nicknamed after an element, a periodic table, south of a bay that's named after the patron saint of about 40 different things.
Wow, that I didn't know.
Yeah, it's amazing, including, I think, like, gardening and ecology and merchants and animals. And
no, there's only so many saints.
This, like, dude's jack of all trades. So we're sitting here with Cassio Sampaio, and Cassio and I go back quite a while, quite a ways. What?
2007? It was going to be 12 years,
12 years, 13 years. Yeah. So we were colleagues for a little while. Then Cassio left the company, came back a few years later as my boss. So lesson learned there. So he was my manager for a few years. And then when Sandvine was acquired and by a private equity firm and merged with our top peer competitor, that was a time where we each left, Cassio first, then myself. And yeah, you had a long history in telecom, and leaving Sandvine represented a departure because you went to a new market, new industry.
It's interesting because it's almost like I went back to where I started, because I started my career in hosting. This is way before virtualization was a thing.
I didn't go that far back on LinkedIn.
Listen, I've been around. Yeah. So when the thing with Sandvine was, like, unfolding, I started to think, like, hey, 12, it had been, like, what, 10 years in telecom? About 10 or 12 years in telecom.
Both the vendor and the telco side.
And the telco, right? Because the hosting company I was with, like, that goes back, like, to the early 2000s in Brazil. It started as a hosting and, like, web property, like, management firm, and then it got bought by a telco. That's how I really got into the telco space. But then, like, after, like, over a decade in that, telecom is not known for moving fast and breaking things, since we're here in this part of the world, I guess we can say that.
When things break in telecom, people get very upset.
People get very upset, including regulators, mm-hmm. which I think is a very important difference of like new tech and old tech, right? There's mm-hmm. no regulation just yet.
New tech can break elections and it doesn't matter.
That's right. So yeah, the decision to sort of maybe go back to what the industry had changed. It changed a lot, like, you know, over like 12 years. It was good. It was still infrastructure. Like, I've been doing different types of infrastructure for, like, forever. And yeah, it felt like a natural move at that, but it's different, mm-hmm. right? Like, then you get used to this cadence, like, in telco. And you and I saw that, like, firsthand is you go from, like, 3G to LTE, 4G. Mm-hmm. And that is, like, a 4 or 5 year journey just to get adoption of the service, like, at peak. And there's another like decade before the technology becomes obsolete. And then the 5G comes and is like this crazy hype cycle that we're going through right now. Yeah. And it's like a decade long process.
Yeah. And those access technologies don't peak until 15 years after we in the sort of the Western world get used to them. They're still getting rolled out everywhere else.
You remember like in the one of our sales conferences, like I put a quiz question on like when 3G was going to peak.
Yeah, it was like 2021.
Like, yeah. So it's like, it hasn't peaked yet.
So when I went to Kiev, Ukraine had rolled out 3G like the year or two before. They were telling me they said, we are the last country in the world essentially to roll out 3G.
Wow.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, for the most part, it works just fine.
But. And then you rely on the services that come from it to pay for it afterwards. It's not paid for first. It's you expect as a telco that the services and the new data, the new things you're going to launch are going to pay for it, which started becoming a real challenge when everything went packet-based and long-distance calls became WhatsApp calls, and all of a sudden those sources of revenue drive. When SMS disappeared because of instant messaging. And I remember when we were looking at 5G, because we were talking about it 4 years ago, probably for our planning.
Yep.
We were expected to help educate our customers as to the different use cases they could deploy. And I remember kind of scratching my head a little bit. Like, it's very hard to predict the impact of new technologies. So, okay, low latency, really high speeds, you know, all the virtual layers and everything behind it. But what does that make? What does that let you do that you can charge money for as a telco?
And the pattern in telecoms being probably like since like 3G, that there's all this like speculation about the possibilities that are going to be unlocked for new telco businesses. And then every other company in the world benefits from that but telcos.
Yeah.
Like look at Netflix, like look at YouTube, like look at like WhatsApp that you just mentioned, or like Skype, not necessarily Skype, but like voice over IP.
Everything over the top.
And
everything as a service relies on this
incredible infrastructure that's built. And without getting to the argument that is that a utility or not a utility, because that's super controversial. But I mean, there are parts of the world like where, like, I mean, I'm sure you've been to some of the developing countries, like, too. Like, you land and you start to look at all the
people on my team.
Like, yeah, people on your team.
People on my team went to the developing countries.
You know, try to avoid that a little bit. But being places like in Africa, in South America, where you would land at the airport and then every phone number had, like, a WhatsApp, like, logo, like, on it. They were not, like, phone numbers. They were, like, WhatsApp numbers.
Yeah.
And there's, like, entire businesses right now that just run over the top. So,
yeah, and it really kicked the legs out of the telco business planning.
Yeah, and this is what's fascinating. Like, I'm not gonna name names, but I remember like at one point, like I was in this like in this meeting, and it was a big meeting, maybe over like 60 people like on it, like in the Great White North. And this is I'll say 2012.
So there were only three companies it could have been.
So it started to get a little bit more specific there, like 2012, and this group of people are pitching RCS, which is the evolution of SMS. And if you ask anyone who actually like knows what's going on, the evolution of SMS is WhatsApp, Telegram. Yeah. It's something that the telco just provides the data for. But anyways, people were presenting like slides with a monetization model for messaging in 2012. And because of the company that we worked for, I was on the receiving end of that and trying to answer like yes or no to questions. Can you charge for like a picture that I'm going to send to grandma according to the resolution of the picture?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking to myself, like, do you understand that this concept ceased to exist like 3 years ago?
This train has sailed.
This, again, maybe goes back to the theory, like if that's your job and that's what you have to do it, like you have to find ways to continue. Like you and I were talking about, I guess, NGOs the other day in the same vein. But
they don't want to admit that it's gone.
That's gone.
A bunch of the people in the room might be saying, look, in 2 or 3 years, I'm retiring, so I'll entertain this obviously false premise because I'm paid to, and then I'll quietly leave.
Yeah, it's a very... Yeah, those back to your original question, those are some of the reasons why I decided it was about to... Time to go time to leave to, telco and go to like a different space. And
you went to a different gigantic network-focused, processing-powered industry of...
Yeah, from a career transition... I mean, I reflected a lot.
You strike me as a thoughtful guy. Like, so I would expect reflection.
Yeah, I thought a lot. And I looked at the sort of the adjacent possible. Like, what are the sort of, okay, there's like so a bunch of synergies, a bunch of things that are going to be new, but it can't be like a giant like leap like that because I know it's going to fail. And at the surface, you can't see them. But telco and cloud, they are about moving, storing data faster, cheaper, and better than yesterday, right? Like, it's a constant move towards efficiency and volume, because there's always going to be more data. There's always going to be more cat video. There's always going to be more cat pictures. Yeah. And they have to sit somewhere. And this desire, everything is instantaneous. If I'm scrolling on my photo feed, that has to be in milliseconds, because that's what Facebook like.
Yeah, so some technology sort of invented, has to... It's amazing when you get into it, because the user experience is so deceptively simple. I'm scrolling through a feed or I'm navigating on a map, but something behind the scenes is fetching those, it's intelligently fetching what you're about to look at so that it can load in the time you're looking at it.
Yep.
And I saw a tweet a couple of days ago where someone basically said, you know, I'm tired of hearing the hype about cloud. It's just a computer on a network. And I wanted to jump in. No, man. The things that have to happen behind the scenes, whether it's queuing or distributed storage or long-term blob storage versus distributed things that you need to access immediately, and the amount of predictive analysis that goes in and fetching those things, and it's incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. And if you look at AWS journey and how they went from simple S3 basic blob storage all the way to where they are today, yeah, it's like the cloud's just someone else's computer, but probably the best way to say is someone else has hundreds of potential like millions of processing units, mm-hmm. like sitting in hundreds of data centers across the globe with crazy low latency across them, and have the ability to want to fail and the other to pick it up, and it goes on and on and on. And that's what Amazon's a fascinating company, right? For a variety of different reasons. But on the AWS side, if you see how organic that growth of that company was, and this, you and I are very passionate about understanding market problems and really nailing your MVP and then nailing your key customers, like going and then sort of expanding your market from that. And cloud was cloud's been that for like about 10 years now, but it still is this fascinating space where there's so much, and nothing is new, right? You're effectively taking stuff that's been done poorly on premises, mm-hmm. or by very expensive, complex, proprietary systems, and moving that stuff somewhere where it's simpler. It's not cheaper, necessarily cheaper, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of people think of cloud as being cheaper, but I mean, in my experience, cloud is cloud because cloud's faster.
Yeah.
Right? That's the first consideration. You get it. If you're a startup and you just want to get stuff done, why are you going to buy a server? You just get from someone else. And it may not be cheaper, but you get the problem out of the way.
Yeah, you're not working with IT to source a server, get it delivered, get it provisioned, up and running, run all your patches, get all your software on. It's a day, it's 2 days of it's up and running.
Yeah, and now the ecosystem of services is incredible. You go through any of the three large cloud providers, the ecosystem is... You can get SAP in the cloud.
It's
like
amazing.
It's not only the leading edge. You can get like stuff that some would call legacy in the cloud right now too, right?
One of the things that I find quite neat about cloud is the access it gives to small companies that wouldn't necessarily have the giant purchase power. You know, if you go back 15, 20 years, companies doing large scale data processing or the applications built on top of that, like machine learning, big data analytics, you couldn't do that without a server farm. And now you could start a company tomorrow and be doing AI applications on giant data stores the next day, which is, it's incredible. It's enabled by cloud. The new technologies and use cases that come along, I guess, larger scale of the old ones, and much more accessible.
Yeah, and the movements in AI are, it's almost like the technology went from complete rocket science and specialized hardware and stuff that maybe a dozen of people in the world could afford, mm-hmm. to, there's a drop down list like on AWS.com, and you pick the size and you go. And now there's blockchain as a service. I'm not talking Bitcoin, I'm talking blockchain, it's legitimate uses. There's
the bleeding edge becomes ubiquitous in an extremely condensed amount of time.
Yeah, and the sheer power that those companies have to continue, I'm not going to use the word innovate because I'm not a big fan of that term, but to ship stuff.
The operational and logistical challenges had to be overcome to build things out at, what, 35, 40, 45% annual growth.
Annual growth. And this is, and if you think for like infrastructure companies, that growth means stuff being racked on a giant data center.
This is where we get back to the, it's someone else's computer. Yeah, someone had to go and hook it up.
And again, that's because, that's probably why like Amazon was so successful in this, because they are a logistics company. And this becomes a logistics problem. If you're growing, let's just take a very simplistic approach. If you have like a million hosts, a million servers like right now, and your business grows 35% year over year, let's say simplistically, they have to grow your server fleet, which is not the case, but you have to grow server fleet at the same pace. How do you buy, rack, stack, install, manage 350,000 servers coming into your data centers? Just the parking the trucks.
It's like 1,000 a day.
Yeah, you start to do the math. It becomes rocket science, right? And and again, it goes back to another characteristic of this business: super capital intensive. Mm-hmm. So only a few companies are truly able to deploy the vast amounts of capital needed to keep the growth. This is a business that could, and smaller companies can face sort of this growth trap. You actually really need to invest a lot to continue growing. And need like access to a lot of cash, a lot of funding. So it's a business that's hard. Like if you're not you're not Bezos, or
you're growing at 35% and you're losing market share, and that becomes,
that becomes
a challenge.
That's the other, like the
which, wow.
We were chatting this morning, right? Yeah. Amazon published their earnings yesterday, and some analysts were upset because they didn't grow 40%. This is not a $10 million business. 40% on their revenue base. It's a lot.
I wonder if and when that's going to slow down. So I think back to the internet phenomena reports that we did, and the, and I'll say roughly 40% year over year bandwidth consumption growth per person. It wasn't uniform, but on average, we look at the mean. And I remember thinking this has to slow down, because you can't, sooner or later it's saturated. Like what's the in the limit sort of logical ultimate conclusion here is what we're streaming ultra HD video 24/7. Like you can't really generate much more data than that. And I remember people got into augmented reality and they're like, because there's going to be 3D or 360 degree video now. That's going to, like Cisco was always about video growth is gigantic because they did a large number of video solutions. Whereas I'd look at our numbers and I think it's slowing down a bit, right? Kind of like the maturity of, like I'm using a laptop from 2013 and it does everything I needed to do and I've never had a problem with it.
You can make the argument that, I guess some people smarter than me, like are making that after the 1960s, man gets to the moon, and then beyond that, most technological improvements have been very incremental.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we may be seeing like, I don't know if it's the tip or, but we're seeing that at consumer technology levels, right? Because the whole mission to the moon was about like large, very industrial technology development.
And things had to be invented.
It had to be invented to do that. And then, and it's like every technology is starting in the military, or it's being like this. Like now it's a little bit different because there's a lot of money and power in the hands of private sector. But it used to be the military, the internet, right? It starts there and then becomes like an industrial function, and then last like moves to consumer. And pretty much every, even like video streaming technology started like this. Like it's video surveillance for the military. It moves like to industrial surveillance. Now it's about cat videos. Mm-hmm. So
always comes back to cat videos. And I love that, I don't love, I think this is ridiculous. Everything is there forever. So the cloud never gets smaller because people want that thing, that picture they took in 2008 to be available. Maybe because they might want to look it up at some point. Now it's not in a low latency store somewhere.
But you know what? I tend to think that everything, like all of this is ridiculous until you become, there was a specific, without spending too much time on that, like one of our sales conferences, like I did my thing in the morning, like sort of just try to get the people going, crack some jokes. And then I needed a picture. I remember like I needed a picture of me when I was a little bit younger, because to put context on a specific thing, you probably remember that. I was sitting at this hotel, I'm not at home, I don't have my hard drive, I don't put a lot of stuff like in cloud, so I was like, God damn it. I had deactivated my Facebook account already. Ha, I deactivate it, but didn't delete it. So if I log in, I'll reactivate. I know there's a picture there. Oh. I'll download and immediately like deactivate again.
Yeah.
No, this is just doesn't feel right. Why do I have to believe that I have the right to go back and find this one thing? Because there's lots of implications. Like, again, we were chatting about this morning of something you say, something you write, something or picture that you take that sits there forever. And then 20 years later, oh my God, like why are you drinking that beer that was GMO and like it was planted in native land? It was just a beer. Yeah. But anyways, there's this expectation that you can have access to everything and anything at all times.
Well, we remember when we couldn't, but the generation growing up, well, so another aspect of when you went over to DigitalOcean, that was, you know, you'd worked with Canadian companies for a long, well, you'd worked with international companies, but you'd worked for Canadian companies for a number of years. And then going to DigitalOcean, they're based in New York. I know they have a lot of remote workers, but the company is based in New York. I'm curious what, you know, given the perspective you have on your career and the thoughtful gentleman that you are, what kind of differences did you observe there? And do you think, were they unique to the organization or are they more representative of a U.S. company, Canadian company approach?
So yes, DigitalOcean is New York based. The majority of the people, I don't remember the stats, but they have that on their websites. But let's say 2/3 of the people are remote, which is probably accurate in there. At least like what I figure is like it has a New York culture. And again, the U.S. is a big place, just like Canada is a big place. So it's hard to generalize and say like, oh, it is like an American company and a Canadian company, because if you're from Montreal, you're going to be different than a Toronto-based company. But if you just for a second say like that DigitalOcean is like an American company versus a Canadian company, the one thing that struck me was the willingness to bet on things without the need to a lot of confirmation. I'm going to say information, because that if there's one thing that I'm going to put DigitalOcean like sort of like in the new sort of new tech versus old tech. New tech swims in data, mm-hmm. right? Like there's even a case study on DigitalOcean on that, but we use like one of the BI tools, from one of the top vendors. I would wake up, if I woke up like at 7 a.m., I would have on my Slack 5 dashboards for the 5 product verticals that I worked on, and I had every single indicator like I needed. I had like adoption by any metric you can think of, like number of users, like models, average like time spent, volume on this. I had every metric you could possibly like imagine, which is sort of the dream of all the telco people, right? And they just don't have it. But these companies, they were raised in this age where like data is king. You have to have data. So they have data.
And they
from
got
day
to
one.
Select their tools from day one.
Yeah. So it's much different way, easier like way to do it.
It's like marketing, the marketing tech stack. If you're building a company now, you just get everything as a service.
That's right.
Versus, oh, you built stuff 15 years ago. You have to figure out a way to migrate.
And now you're stuck with that. Yeah. Like that's the gravity or legacy. Even with all of that data, I felt a lot of the decisions weren't really like data driven. The data was there, but there were bets like made in like new products or even sometimes to pursue like a company acquisition. They were not necessarily, they were like gut based. People just felt it was the right thing to do. And a lot of those decisions were like terrible in hindsight. A few of them were like really, really good. Mm-hmm. But I felt like maybe it's a New York thing. There's a decisive bunch.
I think it's like the outside looking in here, there are a couple of thoughts that come to mind. One, I'm curious if seeing so much data that's on a very short term, like it's how are people using it yesterday and last week? Does that create a weird situation where you're permanently in the short term while you're trying to make long-term decisions? Like you're optimizing for local maxima, missing the big picture. But then what you said at the end there, they're willing to make these bigger bets and bigger decisions. And some of them don't work out, but you gain exposure to this asymmetric upside, mm-hmm. which is unknown. And some of it is. Seems always like such a cop-out to say judgment and experiential and, you know, gut instinct. But is that just our way of synthesizing all of the experience to see patterns? Just like if you ask a professional athlete to explain how they do something, they can't. Their body and their mind has chunked everything.
System one and system two.
Yeah, yeah. And they're just extremely good at it. they're obviously they're thinking as they're doing things, but a lot of the physiological response and everything is just ingrained, and they're interpreting the situation and on all this very interesting data processing that goes on in the head. Is there a parallel here where it applies to business? So an experienced, whether it's investor or manager or leader, sees these patterns, maybe can't even describe them all that well, and so chalks it up to a gut instinct. And you're talking about likelihoods and percentages, so 2 out of 5 maybe will turn out, but they'll turn out enough that your expected value has you growing at 30, 35, 40, 45%.
Yeah, the thing with data, I'm gonna say a whole bunch of things around your question there.
So we created this notion. There's almost two camps. So there was a camp that always needs or feels that they need more data. And it leads to analysis paralysis, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I know how many users of this sort of like segment are using that specific virtual machine size this time for this type of application. Oh, but are there applications like low latency, high latency? And you start to go into this process. And at one point, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Like, I feel like it's a comfort blanket sometimes where people don't want to make a decision. So they're waiting for the data to tell them something.
Yeah. And I believe make your decisions like as soon as, make them early, make them often.
And you can change them.
Like, so if you make them early enough, they give us like time to course correct. And not everything can be course corrected. If you're going to deploy billions of dollars of capital and you deploy them already, can't ask for like money.
Yeah, you have to know the upside and the downside.
The downside, but you have to, I guess you have to believe in something. Back to DigitalOcean, like then at one point, like we had a bunch of new people at the management team like joining. And one of the things that one of them said, it was sort of very interesting, said, you guys are too digital. I'm analog. I think you guys need an injection of analogism because you're not going to be able to create the new thing. You're not going to be able to sort of make something that's too different than what you're making right now just based on looking at like retrospective data. Because that's the thing of that. Data is looking back. Data is not looking forward. I'm going to build a predictive AI model. The predictive AI models are just being like looking at the past, trying to predict the future. Like
leading metrics, Cassio.
Like leading metrics. There was a person at DigitalOcean that was like, that was his trigger. That was his trigger word. They said like leading metrics, like, okay.
You take the lagging ones and you just put a trend line.
That's right. But there was
You touch on, if you're always looking at those, you're doing incremental tweaks. And there are businesses where, like the ones we were talking about, retail and things like that, where operational optimizations of fractions of a percent are extremely important because it's a very mature, very cutthroat, very low margin business. But if you're in a disruptive, high growth business, incremental change is not going to get you on that hockey stick curve, or it's not going to fuel the rocket ship. And the other thing that you sort of alluded to there was the creative destruction. You're not going to destroy yourself, at least cannibalizing your own business to create a higher growth part at the expense of the segment that's the cash cow. And I think in my experience looking around is both talking to people and direct experience is similar. This, you need this willingness to make a bet. And it's an informed, you know, it's as informed as possible, but there's a downside. It might not work.
Yeah, it might not work. But then the other thing too, like back to Canada versus US, if you will.
Not adversarial. We talked about this.
Canada comparative. Canada and the US. Funding is, let's say you all the attributes were there and you have the people with the guts and the vision and all of that, but then you need capital, right? Yeah. You need to hire a bunch of smart people. We need to like buy stuff. We need to hire people in specific geographies. If you have like a direct sales model, like there's stuff that needs a lot of dollars. And the thing, and I don't have any numbers on that, but.
Well, I remember talking to Jackie Murphy on the first one the first podcast that she and I did, and she shed some light, some historical context for me on the institutional changes that happened in the Canadian investment market structure that impacted Canadian companies' access to capital. All of a sudden, it was much harder. There were fewer investors who could supply the capital needed for companies. And if I look at, maybe this is where you're going, I'm stealing your thunder. If you look at the amounts being raised by Canadian companies, you're seeing 10, 15, 20 million. And then you see headlines coming out of the US and it's Series C of 180 million.
Yeah, it's almost like unicorns are really not a thing anymore, right? Because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
Because they get, and you could argue that some of those valuations maybe
they're just fancy horses.
They're just like horse. As my daughter says, they're like horse with like a like an ice cream cone. But the I guess the point is that without the capital, you're gonna have to be making, you're gonna have to be bean counting. And if you're like in growth, at growth stage, you can't be like controlling like, oh, I can't hire. Oh yeah, we're not gonna be able to bring like that the new whatever that person is, because and if you have more capital, like the one thing I mean, most companies of I work for, like we're more in the sort of like not a lot of capital, more conservative with capital deployment, and then even though DigitalOcean was not a, I mean they are not a multi-billion dollar organization or anything, that you can look up their numbers, are pretty open about it, but there was this willingness. If you met someone who was really good and you felt, man, like this person is going to make a difference, like this person, like because we're thinking about this thing, like a lot of times they will hire the person and figure out what to do with it.
Yeah,
like with that person, like, and that is something most companies, like if you're cash strapped, like you just can't,
yeah,
you just can't afford. And then with capital comes like talent, and the reason why there's a lot of people down here like right now is
a force of gravity.
It's exactly that, right? And I know, anyways, you and I always joke about it, like there's every
it doesn't sound like us at all.
Like it doesn't, right? Every, no, I would say every country in the world. Can I get controversial a little bit?
I can.
We can always edit this out later, right? So every country in the world believes that it can make like wine, and it's gonna have like its next like Silicon Valley. I'm sorry, like not every country in the world can make proper wine, but it's like every country or every, like if you go to Canada province, or oh yeah, we're building our like new Silicon Valley, and now it's this whole idea that intelligent design that you can control. I said I was not going to get controversial, but I just did.
Versus emergence.
Versus like this thing here happened. I am sure there were like a whole bunch of things that were thought, but there was like a bunch of schools, there were like a bunch of people that moved down here. There was a culture that was permissive, and
it's a petri dish that allows growth.
The primordial like soup, right? Like it happened. It's not like there was this was it in, I think it was in São Paulo, right? So I guess I'm from São Paulo in Brazil. My mom was telling me like they are emptying out this like giant distribution center down in downtown, which is like big, and they're gonna turn that into like an incubator. And I just couldn't conceive the notion, because the thing is about the size of like what, maybe 10 football stadiums. Mm-hmm. It's like, what are you gonna incubate in a place that size? Like, you're gonna incubate like 100,000 companies?
Dinosaurs?
It's like Jurassic Park. And but they're like, no, like we're building the next Silicon Valley here, and then like the next Silicon Valley in Ontario. There's the next Silicon Valley in Montreal, and there's like multiple. France, I think, changed like a train station the other day into like a giant incubator, and not disputing these people's like
the intention. Yeah.
But there's this notion that you can just build a fancy spot with like bean bags and like ping pong tables and three meals and like
you're very much touching on sort of cart before the horse. People who mistake the very superficial idea of culture with, like you said, bean bags and catered lunches and Nerf gun fights and things like that, versus the reality that often came after from an incredibly innovative environment
and
that attracted quirky people.
And hard work, like the
a beanbag chair is not going to make you a $1 billion company.
No, and the other thing, like we back in the early 2000s, some
way
people are like
back
back
in the noughties. I read that they were referred to as the noughties.
The noughties.
Yeah, rather than just the noughts. I'm like, oh yeah, the noughties.
So that company I mentioned before, like that I worked for, like the hosting guys, like we had a lot of that sort of like startup fun. Like a lot of those, like people would like take your cell phone away and sort of hide it somewhere. Like it was like all day long pranks. It was kind of annoying for new people. When I joined, I was like, I'm not going to last it. This place is super annoying. But you know, like those things were happening 10:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Or like 5 a.m. And that's the part like most, I was going to use like a strong word, but most people like ignore, is that if you actually like look outside, when people are having that fun, it's like it's an outlet, because they've been in the bloody office for 14 hours. Like,
yeah, exactly.
We did email migrations, man, back in the day when like it was almost like taking a hard drive and sort of like stitching the other server. Like we did one where all of us stayed in the office for 7 days, and we were going home just to shower, come back, because there was no automation. People had to sort of type stuff on keyboards. And of course we're doing like Nerf gun fights and stuff like that, because man, people were very tired, and we were drinking a lot of coffee, and we were eating a lot of like stuff. But anyways, that's people part, like the Facebook movie, like what's the name of that movie again?
The Social Network.
The Social Network. If some, you look at like a lot of times, like they actually do that on purpose. If you look at like the camera is pointing out and it's freaking dark,
yeah,
and it's in the summer.
Yeah.
So those dudes are in the office like 11 p.m.
Yeah, I think back to my, certainly my early years at Sandvine, the first, I don't know, 5, 7, however many years, early years seem to last a long time. The number of cars that were in on the weekends and evenings, and I'm not saying companies and employees shouldn't feel obligated to do that, but we were doing it because we wanted to, and we believed what we were building. And I kind of contrast with, like, I have friends who work at a lot of smaller startups, and they've gone there from, you know, let's say, Sandvine, and they cannot believe people roll in at 9:30 and they leave at 4:30. But we're a startup. We have these cool beanbag chairs and all these gimmicks.
It's backwards. It's so
it's completely backwards, right?
Yeah. It's but you know what? Nothing like economic like cycles to take care of like a lot of that, right? And maybe
a couple old men here complaining about the kids.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about funding, and I don't know we'll have all that much time to get into it. But you've got a lot of experience with the merger acquisition side of things. And I've gone through, I think, 3 on the acquiring side and 1 on the being acquired side. And 2 of those where we were on the acquiring side, I'd say quite involved. I was one of the people who was involved more than most. And even to me, the process is incredibly opaque.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think people would be quite interested to learn, is what goes into finding companies, making acquisitions, evaluating them, the due diligence. We always hear about due diligence, right? And intention to acquire gets announced, and then, you know, 5 or 6 months later, the deal might close, or maybe it doesn't. And we only hear about 1 in 20, maybe some small fraction of the opportunities that come along. But that was your focus for the last, mm-hmm, sort of 2 years or so with Sandvine. So just wondering what you could share about that.
Awesome. Yeah. So I'm not an investment banker. So if someone is like interested,
I can tell by your watch.
In those days, that was, remember, like, you're having this conversation. The one thing is, okay, this is great. Like, it was one of my first like sort of corporate development like meetings, and I'm walking to this meeting with a bunch of like bankers, and then the first thing the bankers do when they walk into this meeting, like, they want to like show off their watches, and apparently that sort of dictates the pecking order in that meeting. If you're like on a $20,000 watch, you may be sort of middle of the pack, right? $20,000, like, you're middle of the pack. You feel like on a $50,000 watch, like, you have a good shot of sort of being the top dog, like, in that meeting. But anyways, let's not talk about watches.
And then someone walks in, rolls up his sleeves, thumps down a watch that costs more than a house.
That costs more than, like, many, many, many houses. Like,
and the meeting can start.
And that's the thing with watches. Like, if prices go up, like, I think it's infinitely. Like, I think there's a watch for every budget. Like, even for, like, Warren Buffett, there's maybe, like, a $250,000 watch.
It's a luxury good that's market priced, which is why we need a steeply progressive consumption tax.
That's right.
Oh, damn, we were going to talk
about Hey. But here's probably fine.
All right, corporate development.
So I didn't do any public sort of market like acquisitions. Like we did mostly, we're looking for like tuck-ins. We're looking for technology assets that could help our portfolio from a diversification perspective, but also that came with like a number of customers that have proven that technology. So we're not looking to buy just like IP, so acquihire, right? That, which is a very different
story. Well, even this is interesting, the fact that in your disclaimer here, you're saying, look, my focus in corporate development was this tiny subset.
Yeah, so if you even spend time on that, right?
Because
there's clearly a whole bunch of different reasons, right? Why do the way, like, M&A? Some could be just like revenue. We're gonna, the bankers say, you're just buying revenue. Mm-hmm. Like a company, I don't know, a $200 million company buys like a $50 million company because they want that sort of kick to their top line. Mm-hmm. And then they look into like operational synergies, if it's sort of the same market, like fire a bunch of people and rationalize them and like and all of that.
I love those words.
Like, yeah.
Synergies, rationalize.
Well, that's what they write. What they say is like, how many people can we fire?
Yeah.
Because that's the only overhead companies have these days, right? Like, unless you buy servers. But so can you either buy because you want to grow revenues? You can do it because you really, really found like a piece of technology that doesn't really have customers yet, but you're like, I need that because there's a gap in my R&D, where that can be incredible. And in that case, you're really buying like people and maybe a couple of patents, maybe like a handful of patents. Mm-hmm. So some would call like acqui-hire. And in fact, you pay per head, right? You put like a dollar amount on the number of people that you effectively like buying. And then there was a case at Sandvine where we're looking for not too big, not super tiny, but that will help us with the portfolio completeness to diversify a little bit from the products that we've had. So how did we go about it? So we had this concept of it starts with business development and then becomes corporate development. Like business development, you have to meet a whole bunch of different people, bunch of different companies.
You got to learn what's out there.
Yeah, you got to go
adjacent possible.
Adjacent possible. You got to go and talk to people, and then
and this is you discovering.
That's
and
right.
And then there are also people on sales trips.
On sales trips, and a lot of this comes down to if you want sort of like different product. Let's say adjacent product, same market, then you have to look for companies that, of course, sell to the same customers. Mm-hmm. So get a lot of your leads from your customers, right? We would get a lot of Telefonica or because of our...
They'd say, hey, we're working with this cool company.
Work with this company here. You guys should really talk to them. Like, and in their minds was mostly from the perspective of like, hey, collaborating and like partnering. Yeah. And of course, like...
We want your systems to work better together.
And for it to be cheaper.
Yeah.
Because that's how they roll. Starts like with a lot of those leads, if you will, and then what we did, we started to cluster those into what we call like acquisition themes. So specific areas that made sense for us to investigate. And again, this is completely backwards. If you think this is like intelligent design, you first like lock 5 smart people in a room and come up with like all the different areas. I think it's very organic. You're going to meet a whole bunch of companies. You seed a lot of different people and you get their feedback, and then you categorize those, and then you decide. Look at market A, that we found this market's worth like this many dollars. They sell to these customers. These companies here have this like install base, and maybe it's great complementary to your company because they sold well in Asia and you did only like in North America. But once you look at that, things start to become more obvious. Yeah, there's of course a synergy like in here, this technology. We had the notion that we needed that, but it was never obvious until you meet the company, you see the product in there. And that's how we seeded a lot of the our... M&A investigations. You have to look at hundreds of companies to make like one or two acquisitions. Now you're going to be meeting a lot of people. You're going to be exploring a lot of, you're going to be talking to a lot of investment bankers. There's like what they say, inbound. Like if you get an inbound like email, you get it all the time. The moment you say, I'm the corp dev guy for company A, my company has X dollars in the bank, you start to get this inbound like prospectus. And they're like two pagers. And when you get them, you should be very diligent about it, right?
There's a reason they're trying to sell.
Like, and some companies may be perfectly legit, like they're running out of their sort of funding cycle. And
yeah, their investors are saying
they want out.
We want a return now.
Yeah, and so, but to a lot of them, this is like, particularly the market that we were in, things weren't hard, right? Like telecom consolidates, there's less money around.
Well, the idea, this is something I thought of when we were talking this a few minutes ago about the need for capital. So I'm reading The Prize, as you know, so the global history of petroleum, essentially. And it's incredible because some of the examples are finding these gigantic oil fields, and they know that they're worth the largest economic prize in history, essentially. But they're worried. They're like, oh my God, we need... So they're pumping money in a very almost literal sense, but they don't have the capital they need to develop the wells fast enough to pump the money fast enough. And so they have to go and try to find giant investments, even though it's like a sure thing, right, other than political instability. But the need for the giant amounts of capital to get production up in the time frame they need to serve the global markets. And when we were talking a few minutes ago, time is the enemy for especially companies in tech especially. You can't... if you're going to run out, your burn rate, right? Or if you look at the lean startup, they say measure your runway in terms of the number of pivots you can make before you're out of money. So you're fielding these calls from companies who've looked into the crystal ball 8 months, a year down the road and realized they're screwed.
Yeah, and you have to be... Yeah, it's interesting you're saying that. Just going back to a lot of the inbound calls that we will take... there's a lot of great ideas, right? There were like lots of, probably like more great ideas and poor execution, you know, sort of the other way around. Sort of the discipline to...
Or external factors.
Or there's a lot of external factors, yeah, too. Like company A like has this like giant account and the company just gets bought. It happens a lot in telco, yeah, right? Like company gets bought by big telco in town.
We like this meritocratic idea that if you have a good idea and work hard, everything's going to work out.
No, there's so much stuff that you can't control.
Yeah.
But I mean, and again, unless you, I guess, Microsoft buying GitHub, in which case like going to make a whole bunch of people so rich in there that most of the conversation is probably about money and, okay, sure. The press release said that GitHub's going to continue to be the great thing that it is, but it just made a whole bunch of people very rich. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of not talk at that level of M&A, a lot of the process has to do with getting the team on board, right? Remember, like you and I talked a lot about this with the two acquisitions that went, mm-hmm, through. I ended up spending a lot of time like with the teams in there. Yeah. And it's not about like whining and dining people. Like, no, it's about like telling, making sure they understand that. And you have to believe, right? Like, and maybe I'm naive on this, but
yeah, we believed what
I wouldn't have done. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have done otherwise. Like, it's if you believe in the culture, if you get to know them, you believe they're gonna fit. You know, it's very asymmetric. They can't tell it because they would have met 4 or 5 people from the company because, yeah, you're really controlling information at that point. They can't tell. They're gonna say, "What am I walking into? Am I like a 35 people company? I'm walking to like this like 600 people company." They're like, "Well, how's that gonna be?" So you're the ambassador. You have to explain over and over again.
They met Casio, they met Lee. It's all downhill from there.
Like, it's true too. but there's the element of...
I remember that. I remember being quite cognizant of, you know, going into, I guess, Rotterdam and Zurich. Rotterdam's a larger organization. It was about 30 people.
30 people, yeah.
And I walked in and everyone, you'd been there many, many times. And then I kind of got parachuted in for a week to get ready for the announcement, and everyone just adored you. It's like, geez.
I had lots of beers with that's how you roll like in the Netherlands.
But it's culturally, we knew that it was a good fit. Yeah. That group of people, they were great, they were very competent, they were fun, they were hardworking. Similar, they had been together for 10-12 years, as a company, right? And I guess the cultural fit, especially with that type of acquisition where you're wanting the people to stay, the cultural fit is enormous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And most of the time, companies will have options, right? They will be like 1-2 investment bankers are very good at this. Like if the moment they have one party interested, they're going to go and find a second, third offer, right, to create some competition.
Yeah, like fundamental rule of business, right?
Like, yeah, so they go
second bidder.
And there's always going to be a second bidder. Like in large enough markets, you're always going to find. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times it's going to come down to, do you want to work with these people?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, it could be different. Like if the team doesn't really own the company and it's fully owned by investors, the investor just wants like the highest bid and like to get rid of the asset, sure. But a lot of times the management team will own the company. They'll have a big say on that. So what that means is like, if I'm going to stick around, can I work with these people?
Yeah.
Like or not? And then it's culture too. Like it's certainly much easier. Like I remember having these conversations with our management team. They're like, why can't we find more companies like down here, like in the area? Like why are we looking at these companies like across the pond? And because it's different, right? Like
And we weren't looking in especially exotic places. Like the two that you and I did, Rotterdam and Zurich. Right, so Western Europe.
Yeah, like those places were, I mean, culturally, outside of North America.
They got a head start on their culture.
They're
very, but similar.
But very similar, right? Yeah. Like, arguably, they are in the West.
Western, right? Liberal democracy.
Whatever, like, definition of West, like, you use. But, yeah, it's, but I think culture is big. Of course, like, the business, like, has to make sense. And they have to believe in the vision. They have to believe. The technology people love their products, right? They love what they build, and they want to believe their product is going to go on, like, and it's going to be better, it's going to get more investment. Yeah. Like they need to believe in this thing. So a lot of the time is like spent besides like the due diligence, where you're going to look into every single, you're going to go into like their code, you're going to look into their finances, like, and all of their, like, you need someone to look at the accounting, make sure like their balance sheets, like
there's the data room.
There's a data room stuff, and then you get your finance people sort of to go through that. And
patents, potential legal,
any lawsuits that have happened or that could happen, depending on a patent that they have, that may
upset someone. Sanban was getting acquired, the patent litigation going on in Texas, right? That would have been taken into account as a what's the expected outcome and what's the cost of that and how does that impact?
Yeah, and there's this concept like of warrants. Like you have a warrant that goes into the acquisition agreement that for things that have been identified, let's say company A is buying company B and this company B has this pending lawsuit, there's a warrant in the contract. So like, hey, if you lose, you're going to indemnify me for this. So what that means, like, there's maybe some money that gets like held in escrow and you only get paid when the lawsuit like settles, or there's money that's going to get returned like to the buyers. So acquisition agreements are kind of complicated, right?
They're like hundreds of pages. Yeah, they have to anticipate and cover every
yep.
little
thing. And then the sellers are like, oh my God, like if any of this goes wrong, like we effectively have to pay you to take the company. Because mm-hmm. in some cases it could be pretty, like really, really material.
Yeah. And meanwhile, they're still trying to build and maintain their product or service and service their customers, but the process is consuming enormous resources internally.
And you know, you hit on a good, very good point there. Like if you string along your acquisition target for months and months and months, you're doing yourself a disservice. If you really want to buy that company and you sort of force them to go through like a 14-month long acquisition process, because trust me, they're not going to be thinking a lot about their clients at that point, mm-hmm. right? They're going to be consumed by lawyers and your head of architecture, like trying to ask why you're using this specific library here, like library on your code. And this is super time consuming. And everyone in the company, the employees, they can only think about that. They're not going to think about anything else. So you want to be quick.
You squeezed some blood out of a stone at the cost of 10 extra months of development and customer goodwill and employee goodwill. And
yeah, and a lot of people like spend, this could be controversial with sort of like a lot of engineers, but I've seen acquisitions like fail because someone looked into the code and didn't like how something was like structured in a specific way. And that company had 20 active customers that love the product.
Yeah.
I'm always in the position that I say, like, if you don't have any customers, yeah, we're going to spend a hell of a lot of time on your code. If your product is selling, that's validation. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting we should just ignore the technology and let's make sure that they have the source code for the stuff they built. Let's cover the basics.
And
right?
Is there an architectural issue that will prevent them scaling to a new size of customer?
That's right.
That's the type of thing you want to flag.
But like,
not a comment. The code is poorly commented.
Yeah, I remember like there was a different life and like not at Sandvine. This acquisition process like fell through because there was like this decision on a programming language, like in one specific component that someone in engineering in the acquiring company had like a philosophical issue with. And it was like,
don't use Ada.
Like, if you're a startup right now, things to not do. Ada, COBOL, what else? Perl,
TCL.
But it was really, I enjoyed a lot doing that type of work. It could be very frustrating, like at times.
And then everything could go. So I remember I was in Rotterdam, and I obviously can't get into the specifics here, but I'm just saying from my experience in Rotterdam for a week, I've completely taken down and I'm rebuilding the entire company we're acquiring, their material, their messaging, all their stories. I'm working it into the Sandvine story, and this was all being done. The deal was still being negotiated, and I remember you telling me this could just fall apart at any time, and you hear that. I've heard that in every acquisition, and then I was hearing this, and then towards the end, it looked like it actually might. Which, okay, you lost a week of work, whatever. I got to learn some cool things. I got to go to a cool city. So not the specifics of that deal, but what are the types of things that can suddenly throw a wrench in to the gears at the proverbial or literal 11th hour? Like, is something suddenly uncovered?
There's like there are things that... And this is not like the sellers are like hiding stuff and sort of like, no, sometimes like it's you ask your lawyers to look into like all previous lawsuits and stuff, and they come back to me and say like, you know what, like this thing could come back to bite us because of...
There's exposure.
There's like, something. There's an other company that could sue us like for the exact same reason, and it may have like more of a ground than this company here. Or it could be like you said before, you don't control the universe. Though some people like to believe they do. Like just yet. but... like a large customer cancels a contract.
Oh, yeah.
Think about it. Like you're going through the process, and the reason you're buying this company is because like, oh my God, they sold to the top two potential customers like in Asia, mm-hmm. and then customer A from those two gives a comment so like,
let's get 1% of China.
Like
it's a big market.
And if they cancel, or something else, like
that. An investor doesn't like the deal,
or this is a, there's a lot of egos involved in this, right? Remember the watches, yeah. Like somebody gets upset, they go for a run together, one runs faster than the other, like literally, I've heard this, like people go out for like a run, like to jog, and the other one just humiliates like the other because it's like a like an Ironman like guy, and the other one like feels insulted, like why are you doing this to me, and then the deal like nearly falls apart. It's like, okay, can you just, I just never go for a jog again? And yeah. Like, but there's so many.
Which is, if I may, a ridiculous reason for something like this to fall apart. But
it's,
that's the problem.
It's people, relationships, right? Yeah. I mean, there's so many factors. Like we saw that like in a different process, like where like one of the key employees, like in the process, basically said at the very end of the process, like, I'm not in. Like, you guys don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, so this person's been identified as a major...
It's a key talent.
The acqui-hire thing.
Has to stay. And sort of like 5 days before the deal is like scheduled to close, comes back and say, you know what? You guys are a bunch of idiots. Like, we're not going to do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not in. And then what do? Like, that moment, like, and then without trying to sound like you have to be super strategic, but kind of have to, what do you do? Are you gonna divide and conquer? You have to think, I'm going to drive a wedge. Now, I have to separate this person from the rest mm-hmm. of the crowd, or what is the option? If you believe that's just like a sign that the rest of the team is probably not on board too, but they just haven't realized, it's a very different conversation than really having someone just defecting for different reasons.
Is it flagging a larger risk?
But you have to know these people. Like, and a lot of, this is the part I struggle with investment banking, because it tends to be very,
spreadsheet.
It's a spreadsheet. Right? This is not, you're not going to capture this, like, in the spectrum of 1 to 1,000, what is the likelihood that others feel alike? Like, you have to know these people, mm-hmm. right? And I personally, like, as you know, I enjoy spending time with different people.
Yeah.
So that, to me, like, just, I really love doing that. But if you're running your M&A from like a, so purely like corp dev perspective, you're going to lose on a lot of those nuances. If you're paying a lot of money and it's like a giant acquisition, maybe none of this is relevant because you're making a whole bunch of people very rich on the other end, and maybe they will leave.
Mm-hmm.
But then they'll go to the beach or to a ski resort or some other destination.
That's what's interesting here. I'm sure we could talk for hours about the subject. And even then, talking about your experience and the things that you've been exposed to is a small subset of corporate development and investment banking and M&A.
Yeah, there's all the other aspects, like corporate development. It's not necessarily just M&A. It could be strategic partnerships. It could be doing things like... setting a joint venture in a third location. Like, a lot of that's happening because of how the Chinese government like does business. Like you said, like a joint entity, like in mainland China.
Or hey, going back to the prize, Pulitzer Prize winning, by the way, a lot of the oil companies to generate more capital and to limit their exposure and risk, or to pool, almost socialize, but on a very small number, to pool that risk would partner up. So they were always trying to avoid antitrust regulations while still working together to efficiently enter different markets.
Well, and then if you think about cloud, I don't remember exactly like who was, if I think it's like Facebook, LinkedIn, so Microsoft working together on like specific data center design, because that's the type of stuff that for some companies, like it's known that it is for Google, like sort of part of their critical IP. But if it's not, why not pull like joint forces on that, right? Because there's a huge risk like mitigation component, like massive cost savings back to deploying 350,000 servers per year.
Yeah.
How do you do that efficiently? That type of thing. So I think as the business like grow, you certainly need more of that pooling. It helps in telco too. Remember, like Bell and TELUS share the radio radio network.
Or just even going back to standards.
Yeah, that too. Like finding,
make sure the networks can talk to each other, or the roles that IEEE or Cable Labs, different organizations, or TM Forum.
TM Forum, right?
Yeah.
Apparently, there's a risk that we're gonna have the first time like a two G networks, like a Western like 5G and a Chinese 5G because of what's happening to Huawei.
Yeah.
There was some speculation on this on The Economist like last week that for the first time since GSM was invented. I mean, they'll see the CDMA at one point. GPRS first. Yeah. It's always been one standard. But now because of this situation with Huawei, maybe we're going to have two networks. But
yeah.
different story.
Well,
different
story. We're on the way to having separate internet. Like, that's where governments are trying to get control over what their citizens see.
That's interesting, right? Because is it, don't we have already like multiple, like the moment you have,
I guess I mean on a much more extreme
sort of physical, it's never going to be physical.
Well, then you're getting into nation state warfare. Can you create an air gap or a large enough and a logic gap so that when you attack your opponent country's network, it doesn't, they can't retaliate against it.
They can't retaliate against it, yeah.
But that's probably a separate discussion.
Separate podcast?
Yeah. Let's get philosophical about
we didn't talk much about like business in here. We did talk a little bit, but I'm sure I had a lot of fun having this chat. I'm not sure your listeners will, but...
You know what? They can choose to listen or not. It's not forced into their earballs. I'd like to end with a quickfire round, which is new to the Community Podcast.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I'll just give you a couple options and you let me know. So
do I have to choose one of the options?
You do. Damn. Bieber versus Neymar.
Oh, okay. Bieber.
I thought so. Chalet sauce versus that weird snail thing that we ate in Tokyo. I will remind you, the snail was very chewy.
And it gave me like a heartburn like afterwards. So, but I'll, okay, chalet sauce.
Part of me still thinks we got pranked. Dostoevsky versus Piketty.
Oh, okay. Damn it. Dostoevsky.
Okay, I thought so.
Because he has written more.
Okay.
There's like, Piketty like wrote like one giant thing.
Yeah.
That's just an unfair comparison. Come on. I should have said Dickens versus, like, I can't say.
Yeah, they're different fields. Classical author versus French economist.
French economist, yeah.
Well, yeah, actually, I'd hope to chat a little bit about our mutual love of reading. You've been getting into the classics, I know, much more than I have, but you got a bit of a head start on me. But we can save that for the next one when we're talking about nation-state cyber warfare and other
topics. Awesome.
So thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Lee. This is great.
Oh, I hope you agree that this was great, or at least good enough, and I hope you tune in next time. As always, thanks for joining. Take care.